Hi there, ED residents. So we are coming to you today to start our very first ED residency podcast. I have Katie with me today. She was at our residency class talking to us about burns, and I thought it'd be a good opportunity to sit down and have a conversation with Katie, a little less formal, about some of the things she talked about and some of the things that I'd like to know. So I would imagine you guys would like to know them too. So we'll kind of get started here. Katie, tell us a little more about your background in burn management.
Yeah, so I started in a burn trauma ICU in 2009. And up until April of 2019, that is where I worked. I was anywhere from a CNA to a new grad nurse. I was a nurse at the bedside for about 5 years prior to becoming the nurse educator for the burn center that I worked in.
Well, we're so glad you came, because usually it's our ER nurses that teach this, and it's not a specialty of ours for sure. So while listening to your lecture, I had a lot of questions come up for me. One of the first one was you talked about keeping people's digits frozen until they come to the burn center. And I don't know, in the past, every time I've ever had a frostbite patient, we just soaked their fingers and toes in tepid water and thawed them out and moved them on their way or admitted them after. And so I was really interested to hear more about putting ice on the digits or keeping them frozen, the process of TPA to be given to patients with frostbite, and is that something I would expect to do as an ER nurse, starting TPA for frostbite?
So not every burn center takes frostbite patients. It's typically the burn centers that are in the general location of where it snows. The TPA was started actually out of a burn center in Minnesota, and not every burn center has adopted this TPA practice yet. So depending on where you're transferring your patient to will depend on the care that you'll be told to do prior to transferring them to that burn center. But as far as TPA goes, so the burn center I came from did do TPA, and the process originally started with patients having to wait until they're at the burn center in order for them to start TPA. And then we had just found that not every patient was making it within that cutoff time frame, and we really wanted to ensure that patients were being able to keep their digits as much as possible. And so they actually had started a process for the outside ED to start that TPA, in addition to starting to rewarm the digits. A lot of times, sometimes it's knees, hands, feet, were most often what it was.
So if I'm working in the ER and I have a patient whose toes are frostbitten and we've called and we're probably going to be sending them to the burn center and they say, you're going to start TPA on them there, what should I expect?
It's very important that you get a true weight of that patient, not just asking the patient how much they weigh, because the TPA will be dosed off of the weight, and then also making sure we do a full trauma workup to ensure that they don't have any traumatic injuries that have occurred from why they were in the snow so long, or did they fall and pass out in the snow and that's why they have that's why they have frostbite, why did they pass out, sort of a thing. And so just making sure we have the full story to make sure there isn't any internal bleeding before we start that TPA.
Okay. And how am I going to know how much TPA to give and timeline to give it over?
Yep. So if you are transferring the patient to a burn center that does TPA, they will have a protocol that they'll be able to fax to you. It'll ask you all the different questions about weight history, all the contraindications to receiving TPA. Your team would go through that, and then if they were eligible for TPA, tell you the full formulas that you'll want to use. That bolus dose needs to be the beginning based on what the hourly rate needs to be thereafter.
All right. So another thing you said that was really interesting to me was one of our residents asked you about putting on EKG leads, and you said that you staple those on, and I just had never thought of that before. And I have had patients with burns to the chest, but I don't remember what we did. You said maybe some came with leads on their back, and that's probably what we did. Are there other things that you've stapled? And also in our ED setting, our MDs and PAs do all the stapling. So we use, the little disposable staples mm-hmm. that we get from our suture cart, and they use those for lax. But is that something your nurses do, and or is it something you have providers come in and do for you?
So it was something that our nurses did, and EKG pads were the biggest thing I would say we stapled on. In surgery, our providers would staple the edges of our graft sites and things like that, and then we would remove the staples 5 days after. But the other thing that we have found that works really well is stapling the dressing together so that it doesn't slide down, say, on the arm, but you need the shoulder to stay. So you can staple the arm dressing and the chest dressing together so they don't fall down.
Oh, okay.
And create like a pseudo t-shirt with the dressing, outer dressings.
So I think nurses, if you're listening to this and thinking about it and you have a burn patient, I would say for your EKG pads, it's probably worth telling your doc, hey, I was told by a burn nurse they staple these on. Would you mind stapling them on? Because that's not something we usually do. But what a great idea to staple the dressings together. And so that kind of takes us to the next question about dressings. So when you're bringing them together and stapling, first of all, if you're doing gauze, do you do Telfa under that?
Zeroform typically.
Oh, okay. Zeroform gauze.
Yep.
And we were always taught, at least I was always taught, coming up in the ER, that we put all burns with sterile saline-soaked gauze. And I know we've been trying to teach over the last few years to not do that anymore, to put a sheet. Some places have sterile burn sheets, specifically in a wrapper. Others don't. And so I just thought maybe this was a good opportunity. I know we had one question from a resident this week about what if the patient's clothing was burned to their skin? Do we want to peel that off? Do we want to put sterile saline gauze? I know our thought in that is moistening the clothes to make it easier to pull off, but Katie mentioned more on temperature control of our patient. So can you talk a little more about dressings?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's very important that whatever you transfer your patient in, that it's something that is going to continue to keep them warm when they get outside. So that's why the saline soaked gauze is not a good choice to be on larger surface burns, because it will decrease their core temperature rapidly. Even if you put warm water on that gauze, it's not going to stay warm. It will then turn cool shortly after you put it on. They will continue to get colder and colder. So super important. You don't really have to dress it with anything. If you just get a dry sheet, doesn't have to be sterile, but a dry sheet that's clean and put it over the patient, or sometimes it's more comfortable if you just wrap the burn dry gauze when you're sending them. The only thing to be careful with that is the length of time that it'll be on, because it can stick to that wound if it's not wet enough. So really the dressing choice matters when it comes to if your patient is going to go home and then follow up in a burn clinic afterwards, or if the patient is not going to be able to transfer to the burn center for an extended amount of time. That's when you'll want to actually properly dress that wound.
So if I have a patient with a burn on their arm and I'm told to put a dressing on, long ago we were always taught the Silvadine cream, and I know we don't do that anymore. We don't have any ideas on why we aren't doing that. And then secondly, you said for that patient, use a Zeroform dressing with gauze over it. Anything else?
Yep, so Silvadine is still rarely used in burn centers, but it still is used at times. There's been evidence that has shown that the Silvadine will impede wound healing, and it slows down the healing process and sometimes can deepen the wounds. Mm-hmm. And so that's really why people have moved away from using Silvadine everything. At times they still use it for full thickness burns, because you can't really get any deeper than a full thickness burn. And so depending on availability, things like that, they may still use it. But most often than not, they will tell you to put a patient in bacitracin Zeroform and then wrap it in gauze.
Okay. All right. So next I was thinking, if I am transferring my patient from one of our Centura ERs to a burn unit that Katie's working at, Katie, how do you want to receive report from me? What's some of the things you want me to say, and what would make that the most efficient phone call we have?
Yeah, I would want to know an accurate size of burn, so TBSA of the burn, even if you don't know the exact number, being able to tell us what is burned, what extremities, what areas are burned, if they're circumferential or not, and then what depth, because if it is a circumferential full thickness burn, that is that could lead to a bigger emergency than if it's a partial thickness burn that is on the anterior portion of the body but not circumferential. So that tells us a lot of what we need to get ready in the rooms for when the patient arrives, and it tells us we can then calculate around how big that burn would be.
Would you give us any recommendations over the phone if, say, you feel like I'm not giving enough fluids or...
Yes, so typically we would want to make sure that if the burn is greater than 20% TBSA, that you have LR running at 500 mils an hour for an adult, and then 250 for children ages 6 to 12. We would want to make sure that we have checked to see if a patient has an up-to-date tetanus, and if not, if they have received it. We would want to know urine output if they have a Foley. If the burn is greater than 20%, you would want to make sure that we're putting in a Foley so we can get that accurate eyes and nose count for the urine output, because that will determine the fluid levels that we run. We would want to know just any presenting story that you guys got from the scene. So were they entrapped in the building? Were they enclosed in a small space? Were they involved in a traumatic scene with the burn? Just really that background story to give us that full picture of what our priorities would need to be.
All right. Is there anything you can think of that you want to make sure I know to do before I send them, aside from the things I tell you? Like when we were really first starting with stroke care, TPA and shipping patients, they would say 2 large bore IVs, get a Foley if you can before TPA because we can't stick them again later. So is there anything you can think of that if we would just do these few things before they come to you, it would make your life easier?
I mean, I think as many large bore IVs that you can get, typically when the patient shows up to the ED, they have not started third spacing and getting edematous and things like that. And so it might be the easiest time for you to get those IVs is at the beginning. If the transport time to the burn center is extensive, there's a good chance they may already have started becoming edematous and just a little bit harder to stick those for those IVs. Let's see, 2 large bore IVs. Just make sure we're keeping them warm. We're removing the jewelry, again, because of that third spacing process that can occur and the leaky capillaries. Getting that jewelry off afterwards can sometimes be extremely difficult. I remember there was a case that I had of a lady that had a jade bracelet on that she had never taken off since she was a child, and they forgot to take it off of her hand, and then she was my patient, and it was about 24 hours or so after her injury, and her hand got so swollen that her hand was turning purple. So we had to have maintenance come and salsa all the jade bracelet off because we couldn't get the cutters underneath it. Yeah, so your basic trauma workup. It shouldn't be any really that different. Making sure they have fluids, making sure they have pain meds and access to pain meds. And you know, at first a burn patient is probably going to be in their fight or flight mode, and so they may not be feeling pain, but as they start calming down a little bit, that pain starts ramping up quite a bit.
So you had mentioned in residency the patient metabolically is like running a marathon. Yep. For days. So do we need to think about blood sugar at all?
Yes, but typically we try to start food or tube feeds quick enough that it's not usually as big of a problem.
Okay.
When they get super sick and septic, their blood sugars will shoot up, but mm-hmm. low blood sugars from the burn injury is not very typical.
Okay. So you taught us about staging their, well, I think of staging wounds, but you taught us about the different stages of the burns and how mm-hmm. to decide what's what. Is mm-hmm. that something that I would document, or am I just going to do colors and descriptions and wait for the burn process to finish?
Yeah, so either one would be fine with the receiving burn center. I think just knowing the difference between a circumferential full thickness and a circumferential partial thickness is the big piece that we want to know. And then knowing that superficial burn, so that sunburn, is not accounted for in that percentage, because a lot of times they're a patient's transferred to us, we're told that they're 25% TBSA. We start the full burn resuscitation protocol at 20%. And then they show up and 15 of it is just red. Mm-hmm. Or you wash it off and it was soot and there isn't really any burn underneath it. And so just trying to get as accurate of details as possible when giving that report so that we can get an accurate number would be the most. And if that is just explaining where the burn is and what it looks like, that is perfectly fine too.
Okay. Is there anything else you could think of clinically that you think we should know in the ER or do better?
I think the only other one I can think of is when we talked about intubation and making sure that we are not intubating too soon. Obviously, it is important to intubate if we need to, but not assuming every facial burn needs to be intubated and waiting to make sure that there's actually signs of distress or the need for intubation prior to just jumping the gun and intubating.
Yeah, that was super interesting to me because mm-hmm. it's what we teach.
Yep.
Even I was an item writer for the CEN review manual, the ENA, and one of my triage questions was, if you have singed nasal hairs or a hoarse voice, intubate.
So a hoarse voice, absolutely.
Okay.
Because that means there is some damage.
We know it's down there.
Singed hairs, they're right on the surface. And so very often you can have a patient that has singed hairs, but they may have been outside and they weren't enclosed in a space. And so they may not have actually inhaled anything. Mm-hmm. And so that isn't going to, their airways aren't going to swell like the one with the hoarse voice.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Very good.